Hey everybody, welcome back to a special edition of the Star Wars Survival Guide, where we're talking about the movie The Force Awakens. And basically what I'm doing is, this is what I would call not a commentary, where I discuss the movie from maybe a critical standpoint, a fan standpoint, historical perspective, you know, all the ways you discuss a new Star Wars movie, you know, the ways that we discussed them when the prequels came out and everything else. So essentially what I'm doing is watching the movie, and as things come to mind, I discuss them here. I also happen to be washing dishes at the same time. So this will make for an interesting experience, to say the least, to see if I can keep a conversation going or a thought going. And of course, it'll be probably fairly well edited because I'm sure there will be gaps and strange noises and things like that. But you know, when you're a podcaster, life goes on around you sometimes, and there are things you have to get done, so you have to multitask. And I don't like turning my recorder on while I'm driving and recording that way. So, well, we're going to try this as we wash and put away the dishes. So, first off, the first character we come to know, in albeit a limited basis, is Finn. And, well, really, actually, it's Poe Dameron. And initially, it was a little off-putting, because obviously it's a new, it's not really a new universe, but it's a new time in an old universe, new characters, new things going on. And so the minute you see Poe, there's a few things going on. Number one, it kind of has a Bond-esque sort of vibe, not a Daniel Craig Bond, but, you know, sort of like here's a secret agent for the rebellion, or in this case, the resistance, off on this desert planet. And we run into Laura Santeca, who we don't know where he's from. All we know is that he's a person of some importance, as I believe, as C-3PO would say. So we don't really know who he is because we never saw him in previous editions of Star Wars. And it was a little weird because we assume that we're going to run into him in books or comics or things that come out surrounding or in between Return of the Jedi and Force Awakens. And we assume he's from that period. The next person we meet is Finn. And Finn, you know, John Boyega. Initially, there was some debate about, oh, we have a black actor in Star Wars. Why do we have a black hero? And of course, then came in the anti-whitewashing of Hollywood, and how this is just pandering to special interests and all of that garbage. And I honestly could not tell you where this stuff comes from. I was raised by a single father who's pretty conservative, not totally conservative, but politics was never a big thing in our house. And I grew up in Northern California, but we went to an Assemblies of God church. My dad's very, you know, Bible-believing sort of guy. But I was never taught that anyone was less than me simply either because of their skin color or their gender or anything like that. It was never like that. The thoughts never even crossed my mind. So I see John Boyega cast as Finn. I was like, cool, you know, it's a stormtrooper, you know. And so what? It's a black stormtrooper. Of course, stormtroopers come in all people groups and skin colors and personalities. And why not? You know, why not let it be something different? And there doesn't have to be a political calculation involved. You know, that's my thought. And the same thing with Rey as a hero. And I'm in the scenes now where she's in the desert. And of course, she's so cute when she puts on the X-Wing helmet. And you get that sense that there's something linking her to the past. And we see the homemade pilot in the orange flight suit that she made herself. We assume she made herself. We see the lines on the wall. We assume that there's some sort of connection between her and a rebel pilot of some sort. And so automatically we start wondering, hey, is she Luke's kid? Does she remember something about Luke being her dad? Or one of my theories, I thought that she could possibly be the daughter of Wedge Antilles. But there's something visually connecting her with the past of Star Wars. Some sort of previous entity. Now, we know from the history of George Lucas that the episodic stories within Star Wars have all been about the Skywalker clan. And there's, of course, a lot of debate and a lot of everything else. No one knows who Rey is. No, all we can do is piece together clues, and there's nothing really specific to say that she's either Luke's daughter or not Luke's daughter or Han and Leia's kid, but you can sort of put some stuff together. Now, we assume, you know, J.J. Abrams likes to throw things in there to make you think. You know, he's got the whole secret box business, right? And so a lot of this, you can't necessarily take it all at face value because, you know, J.J.'s a little bit of a plotter. However, J.J.'s not the guy producing the ongoing saga. This is all a collaborative effort between the story group and their various directors and screenwriters. And we knew Rian Johnson had something in the works anyway from the moment he was selected as the director. And of course, they've worked all these things out. But what Lawrence Kasdan and J.J. Abrams were essentially doing was establishing ground level for the sequel trilogy. It's, you know, these are who the new characters are. Here's a little bit about their background. Here's a little bit of what they can do, but not a whole lot of depth. I mean, if we had to be honest, and now I can't remember who it was making this assertion. He wrote a blog post about it, and I tweeted him about it. And I thought it was Jason Ward of Making Star Wars, but I don't think so. I think it was somebody else. Basically saying how the prequels were better stories than The Force Awakens. And of course, immediately it's like, wait, what? What now? What? You know, that can't be right. But when it came down to it, you realize that there really is not a whole lot of depth to what happens in The Force Awakens. There's a lot of color. There's a lot of incidents that kind of give you some idea of who the characters are. There's a lot of humor in it. You know, it goes back to what Lawrence Kasdan said in all the interviews. He says that when he and J.J. were first talking about it and breaking the story, they wanted to just, you know, what delights us is it was the question that was foremost on his mind. Was what delights us? What makes us happy to be in this Star Wars universe? And so everything was kind of based out of that. And so what you have is kind of a fun, campy adventure with a little bit of weight to it as far as the Force and the future of the Jedi and whoever the First Order is and Snoke and all these guys. You know, it's just kind of an overarching picture of where the galaxy's at and what's going on. Of course, you need a story to go along with it. And of course, why not Echo? You know, here's a vast new super weapon that instead of just killing one planet can take out several at once. And an entire fleet of spaceships. And a transwarp laser. Why not? Because something the EU did a lot of was super weapon of the week. So there is that concept. And sure, it got tiresome a little bit in the EU, but what else are you going to do? You want to, and this is, again, this is from George. The echoing, the callbacks, you know, the rhyming, the visual rhyming, as it were, where things remind you of what came before. And so he had a lot of that. He had a lot of that the way the prequels visually and plot-wise line up with other movies. And this this comes from Mike, it wasn't Mike Klimo, who wrote the, now I can't remember, The Ring Theory. Yeah, I think it was Mike Klimo. Star Wars Ring Theory. And if you look at it, how basically the Phantom Menace and Return of the Jedi are almost bookends in the way they operate, but it's also a little bit like A New Hope in that, you know, the mentor character dies and all that. But the scene at the end with Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon was essentially like Luke and Vader in the hangar at the end of Return of the Jedi. So you have that. And then you have, of course, the funeral pyre at the end. And instead of a victorious ritual burning of the hero's carcass at the end, this is kind of the Phantom Menace ends with darkness. So same thing with Force Awakens, echoing a lot of A New Hope. There's a lot that happens there that's very, very similar. That does a lot of echoing. And even sometimes, you know, from a comic level, you have Han Solo going, okay, so it's big. There's always a, you know, how do you blow it up? There's always a way to blow it up. And Leia says, Han's right, you know? There's always a way to blow it up. You know, it does do a lot of that echoing of A New Hope. So, depth-wise, The Force Awakens is not as deep a story on a story level. You have a lot more going on with the Phantom Menace than you do in The Force Awakens. There's a lot more depth to it. There's a lot more, the stakes are a little bit different and more wide-ranging for every character. Instead of, hey, the stakes are pretty much the same for everybody, we've got to destroy this thing, this big, nasty weapon. But the great thing about what The Force Awakens does is the way it introduces you to these new characters. And each one of them is very individual in the way they operate. So Finn is your skeptical, everyman character who's just kind of caught up in this thing going on. He doesn't want to serve the First Order. So I'm going to break this guy out of, you know, Imperial prison or First Order prison, you know, Poe, and then escape. And then Poe's the idealistic, cocky, like, we got it all together. This is the right thing to do. We are the good guys. That droid has a map that leads straight to Luke Skywalker. We've got to have it. And Finn's like, oh, you got to be kidding me. And then you have Rey, who is that wide-eyed, curious person who basically fills the hero's journey role and the Campbellian hero's journey. And, you know, what can you say about Daisy Ridley? She's probably the most adorable lead actress probably right now. You know, came out of nowhere. Kind of resembles Natalie Portman a little bit. And I forget where I was on this. I think I was getting into who I think Rey is, but maybe not. I think I was getting into the fact that we really don't know who Rey is. But we can make certain assumptions. We can look at certain evidence and go and kind of get an idea. And JJ's trying to throw us off the scent sometimes. So what we have is really a real situation where we just don't know who she is. We don't know what's going to happen to Finn because he was injured in the fight with Kylo Ren. We don't know what's going to happen to Kylo Ren. He's got to go back to Leader Snoke. We're going to probably see more of the First Order. And we're going to see, you know, Leia taking more of the reins of leadership. And I'm wondering, I can't help but wonder, and this is a little weird maybe, if Leia might not go the way of Palpatine. And this may be sacrilege, and this may be unconscionable to think of, and Princess Leia turning bad, but you'll do a lot of things to protect people, to protect the people you love. And we saw that that's exactly what happened with Anakin, is he went to certain levels because of his effort, his desire to protect Padme. She was, the one he loved, and he was afraid of losing her. And so what is Leia afraid of losing? And to what length is she willing to go not to lose it? And did Luke feel like, did he go away to avoid following the path of his father? Did he see darkness, the dark side showing up in Leia, even though she says things like, oh, there's still light in him, and and all this stuff, and even though we assume she's the good guy, did Luke see some of that stuff from their father in her that scared him away, as well as, you know, oh, I didn't, you know, I lost everything, my most promising student turned to the dark side. I'm sure there's a lot of that. I'm sure there's a lot of self-defeat and that kind of thing, and gosh, I'm just retiring, I'm getting out of the game, you know, whatever, I'm going away. Or maybe he was looking for the first Jedi temple because he thought maybe there he could commune with ancient Jedi and get a feel for what's going on. And maybe he ran into a situation where he couldn't do it himself and just kind of laying low. Of course, the whole galaxy is looking for him. The First Order is looking for him. You kind of got to lay low. And after Kylo did what he did, he's the only one left again. And perhaps very difficult or what have you for him to make his way in the universe without help, without somebody there by his side as an apprentice or as a helper or whatever. And which leads us to the next thing is, what is that? Is that a gravestone at the end where he's up on the mountain and Daisy shows up or Rey shows up there? Is that a gravestone or is it just a rock propped up, or maybe it's a makeshift gravestone or a monument, or, you know, maybe that is the first Jedi temple, and maybe that's, you know, here lies the first Jedi. I don't know, maybe there's a limerick on there or something. I don't know. But, you know, who is that his wife? And it'd be very easy, since, you know, he appears unmarried at the time, be very easy to insert Mara Jade here as a character, an actual character in the universe. Which, as an aside, well, I can talk about Rogue One later, but right now we're talking about The Force Awakens. Now, I haven't really expressed my thoughts and feelings about the movie. Let me continue about the characters, and then we'll get into, you know, overall thoughts and feelings and review-type stuff. But anyway, love Rey. She's probably my second favorite Star Wars character after Luke and Han and Darth Vader and Jar Jar Binks. So, you know, she's number 2 out of 8. tied for second place. Luke has always been my favorite Star Wars character, but really, I think Rey has taken leaps and bounds up there. She's my favorite of the new characters, but I like them all. I think Finn, you know, John Boyega has a lot of good comic instinct, you know. I am with the Resistance. Yes, I am with the Resistance. You know, and why you got to get back to Jakku? You got family there? You got a boyfriend? Cute boyfriend? Just love it. So, you know, very well done on the directing and the script writing. And so Kylo Ren gets a lot of grief for being emo. But really, the dark side is emo. The dark side is all about tapping into raw, primal emotion. And just using the power of that for your own strength through the Force. And of course, it's a corrupting influence. This is something that came through the EU, was more that Palpatine's wrinkling and vast aging was a product of corruption of the dark side, and George reduced it to, oh, hey, I just lightninged myself to look like this. You know, there's no... It's kind of like instantaneous. Why would he do that to himself? That just, maybe that just amplifies how sick in the head Palpatine was. That he was willing to go to that length for the power. He's willing to go to that length for his apprentice to turn to his side, to use that, you know, the what do you call it? The scarring, to use that to his benefit politically. Say, you know, look at what they did to me, and that does come out. That is part of it. So, you know, Kylo, again, tapping into that raw emotion and that anger, that's what gives him power. And so, yeah, people laugh, oh, he's throwing a tantrum. Yeah, he is. He's slashing up computer bits with his lightsaber because he's angry. And the, you know, probably has been taught that that anger is what fuels your power, and the only way for you to be strong is to be angry all the time. And the angrier you are, the stronger you will become. And so that's, I think, probably what Snow's been teaching him. And so at every occasion, he will use what he can. He will use his anger. He will use his pain. He will use whatever he can as motivation, as fuel. And I think that's what makes him so engaging as a villain versus Darth Vader, who's cold and calculating and even, and you never see him lose it. He's always in control of everything. And Anakin's biggest thing was always control, control, control. Whereas Kylo's thing is probably anger and power. It's just anger, anger, anger. I'm so angry at my parents. I'm angry at my father, who was never there for me. I'm angry at my uncle, who, you know, never really cared what I felt and always told me to suppress my feelings. And, you know, he never had that time, you know, to mature or to grow. You know, maybe Leia sent him away too early before he could, you know, perhaps he needed that nurturing environment. You know, this is could be an entire exploration into child psychology and raising your kids. And there's a lot of lessons there. I think there's a lot of lessons for us as parents that we could take from this. And that's the thing about, you know, George, again, he was right. Star Wars is kind of like a soap opera. Now, it's not technically a soap opera, and I don't think it should be a soap opera. It's a space opera. But and George Lucas kind of, with Star Wars, sort of helped define what a space opera was. I mean, yeah, there was Dune, and there was some, you know, Ursula K. Le Guin and lots of other sci-fi stuff out there. But, you know, Star Wars helped define the genre for a whole generation of people. And it essentially defined what space opera is. And space opera is a soap opera. You know, this is a saga. It is the Skywalker saga. And, you know, there's still that element there. So there's a lot to take from that angle. Now, other characters, I really like General Hux. I thought Donald Gleason did a really great job of just laying it on thick. I just love his character. I love his performance of the character. General Hux is kind of weak, but see, here's another thing. He's following in the footsteps of his father, who kind of developed this whole program for training these children up from birth, taking them from their homes, training them up as stormtroopers, and that was their life, and that was who they were, and that was his thing. And so when Kylo's confronting him about the bungling of his troops and maybe Leader Snoke should consider a clone army, that's a direct dig at Hux and his father. So anyway, Captain Phasma, profoundly disappointed in the way Captain Phasma was used. I mean, you have this whole thing set up about this awesome armor, about getting more women into Star Wars, having a female villain in Star Wars, and how cool is this, and how awesome is she? And she essentially gets tackled by a Wookiee and stuffed in a trash compactor after taking down some shields. Really weak and useless, and very, very disappointed. So I really hope there's some redemption there for Phasma, that somehow, you know, wherever she got put, she got out of it and escaped the planet before it blew. And if she didn't, what a waste. And I'm talking, you know, a bigger waste than Darth Maul. Because Darth Maul at least did stuff. And then he died. And then we got stuck with, you know, 80-year-old Christopher Dooku. You know, "Ooh, Obi-Wan, this is a terrible mistake. Join me on the dark side. Here, let us fight with lightsabers in extreme close-up, and the rest is a CGI head double." You know, it's like a CGI double with my head superimposed. It's like, eh. Oh, anyway. That's kind of how I feel about Captain Phasma. And then Grievous, of course, you know, we're talking about The Force Awakens, not the other stuff. Anyway. So, and Snoke, who knows? Who knows what's up with Snoke? The characters that, you know, Han Solo and Chewbacca, awesome. Harrison Ford can still do it, man. And of course, the big hairy thing, the big walking carpet was great. Carrie Fisher was, you know, herself as Leia. And again, I'm kind of wondering where this is going to go, because you want to talk about, you can say that Snoke is the one that is the mirror for the Emperor, but, you know, if they're turning things on their heads, why not turn galactic politics on its head? And let's figure out, you know, they say the most engaging villains are the ones that believe they're doing the right thing for the right reasons. So, you know, are we going to start developing sympathy for the First Order? And what happens there? You know, it's like, oh, well, gosh, maybe I don't know who to root for in this case. We're still rooting for the same people we rooted for, but now it's like, oh, well, I really have to think about it. So I'm just wondering if they're going that way, if they're going to turn some things on their heads. So I know there was some talk about them doing some really interesting things with Episode 8. At least that's what Scuttlebutt is saying. So, and there was Maz Kanata, who very masterfully played by Lupita Nyong'o, didn't do a whole lot in the movie. And honestly, on the special features, on the deleted scenes, it didn't have... I was led to believe there was a scene where they were in the halls of Maz Kanata's castle, you know, fighting stormtroopers inside there, that Maz was using the Force and all this, and there's none of that on the deleted scene. So maybe that's, I don't know, maybe that's down the road in the inevitable box set, you know, and after Episode 9. But anyway, so my overall thoughts and impressions of the film. What place does this movie have in the Skywalker saga? You know, in the overall Star Wars canon. You know what? I don't know. I don't know how to put it. Where does it stand? Is it my favorite of the six? Wow. Is it my favorite of the seven? How does it compare to other films? And I think A New Hope was very much outside of its time. It was a timeless thing. It was made in 1977. I mean, we're talking how many years now? Almost 40 years from when it was released. And when I was born in 77, I would be able to track that. 39 years, yeah. and... So it's a different movie. And I think where The Force Awakens doesn't echo A New Hope, it's very much a product of its time as well. But with some classic, you know, classic sensibilities. It's not too modern to fit within a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. It fits very much within that milieu. And I think it's a little different because when you look at it, it's a visual thing. Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, the Indiana Jones movie. The one that people say, oh, it doesn't exist. There's only three. Shut up. You're the same people that whined and cried about how crappy Temple of Doom was. So I don't even want to hear it. You know, same criticism leveled toward the Crystal Skull was leveled towards, you know, Temple of Doom. This isn't an Indiana Jones movie. What happened? You know, George got his pulp jungle adventure with the occult people, and that was his thing. And so, you know, with Crystal Skull, he got his Indiana Jones versus aliens. Ha ha ha, isn't that awesome? Okay, moving on. You know, he once treated a story, I think, Indiana Jones and the Saucer Men from Mars or something, and that's where that comes from. So, but visually, Crystal Skull seemed different. It didn't seem as big. It didn't... I don't know quite how to put it. But the cinematography was different. It just didn't have that feel that Raiders and Temple of Doom and Last Crusade had. And I don't think it was... You know, sure, there were some elements of the story probably that were bad or cumbersome. I mean, the MacGuffin was probably the biggest problem. The Crystal Skull that nobody really had heard about or cared about. We all knew about the Ark of the Covenant. We all knew about the Holy Grail, and I think maybe that was the problem with Temple of Doom, was who cares about these Sankara stones? But it's Indiana Jones rescuing slave children from occultists in India. What's not to love? So anyway, from a visual standpoint, Crystal Skull felt different. You know, Harrison's portrayal was fine. The script was fine. The dialogue wasn't bad. The action was good, except for the monkey vine swing thing. There's a little bit of the, you know, CGI in the jungle chase, but this is a pulp adventure. It's supposed to be silly. It's supposed to be outlandish. And I think people wanted to take it too seriously. So we look at Last Crusade almost like, oh, it's like, well, it's a holy movie. You know, it's the Holy Grail. You know, I don't know. But I feel like The Force Awakens touched on all those levels that Star Wars fans want or wanted to be touched on with the prequels. And George just went a different direction. He was making a Greek tragedy, not a space opera. A Greek tragedy set in space. A space Greek tragedy, you could say. Which, again, very actually operatic. Very operatic. So, anyway, there's that. So, as far as quality, I mean, I really hesitate to rank it up there with The Empire Strikes Back. There's a lot of people who say, oh, this is the best Star Wars movie ever. I wouldn't go that far. This is probably the most fun Star Wars movie that I have ever watched. I would say that for sure. Force Awakens is the most fun. It's the most campy humor. It's the most action comedy without being slapstick. So it's definitely the most fun to watch so far. And I think, again, I think a lot of that is Abrams and Kasdan just going, what delights us? And the same thing that delights them is the same thing that delights us. Because if they're having fun with this story, we're having fun with this story. So, you know, that's why I think this movie is so much fun. Quality of filmmaking, again, Empire Strikes Back is what we would call a masterpiece of the genre. And, you know, and Star Wars, for its time, was a masterpiece of the genre. This is not, The Force Awakens is not what I would call a masterpiece of the genre. It's good, it's fun, and it's not fun without being stupid. You know, it doesn't completely lose all its narrative heft for the sake of being fun. It maintains its dignity throughout, I guess is what the way I want to say it. And so there's that. Just tell that to Kanja Club. So anyway, I love the movie. So as far as fun to watch, number one, The Force Awakens. Number two, I gotta say, for me, The Phantom Menace. After that, Empire Strikes Back, or Return of the Jedi, and then Empire, and, you know, we're talking fun to watch. Then A New Hope, then Attack of the Clones, and last, Revenge of the Sith, is not fun to watch at all. There are fun moments, but, you know. Now, as far as quality of filmmaking, number one has to stay with Empire Strikes Back. Number two has to be, for me, A New Hope. And I think that's reasonable. I think most fans will probably rank those in that order as far as quality of filmmaking. And after that, honestly, I think The Phantom Menace is a better story for the fact that... Return of the Jedi after that. And then Phantom Menace is best of the prequels to me because it was George while he was still in that innocent mode of, I'm just making the movie I want to make. I'm telling the story I want to tell. John Williams' music supports it. It's got that whimsy. It's got that warmth to it. It's got, you know, Liam Neeson as Qui-Gon Jinn and everybody else in there. And you can say what you want about Jar Jar Binks. I will sit here and tell you, I love Jar Jar Binks. I think he's hilarious. I thought he was hilarious from the moment I saw him. There were moments I thought, stepping in dew, stepping in Bantha Poodoo was a little... great, that's hilarious. Kids ought to love that. The farting Yopi at the pod race, was like, I could have done without that. So there were some little childish, immature things thrown in there that we could have done without. But I thought Jake Lloyd, for an 8-year-old, did exactly what he was supposed to do. You know, so you can say what you want about the choices that George made, but the quality of the movie, it's not a bad as far as movies go. And you can say, well, the whole politics thing, but yeah, but that's what this was supposed to be about. How did we get from Republic to Empire? It's not just about how did, you know, Anakin go and become Darth Vader. That's chief of the issues, but also how did the galaxy get from here to there? Which is something that The Force Awakens completely ignored. And so maybe there is a lesson there. And I think that George probably had a little too much of the political angle. You know, that's you don't want to see all the machinations. You just kind of want to get a flavor for something's happening here. You know, something's going on. I'm writing that line with one of the books that I'm writing. Is kind of watching a culture and a government go from, you know, freedom, kind of a free monarchy, to a totalitarian state. You know, how does it get there without boring the reader? And so, yeah, there are moments of the Phantom Menace that simply bore the viewer. You know, Palpatine in his chambers talking to Padme, it is not high action drama, okay? There's not a lot going on there. You're learning stuff, but it's kind of, you know, it's kind of dry. And Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon before the Jedi Council is like, oh, what are we doing here? We just saw a 27-minute pod race, and now we're stuck in the Jedi Council chamber. Like, oh, what are we doing? So I get it. I get that part. But I still think better movie than Attack of the Clones, which couldn't figure out what it wanted to be. Did it want to be a space noir Jedi detective story? Or did it want to be a love story? Or did it want to be a war story? George wanted it to be all three. And then Revenge of the Sith just moved too quickly. Now, some people say, well, the pacing is great, and it works like a space opera and a tragedy, and it flows like it's supposed to. And I disagree, but regardless. Force Awakens, at least up there in the top three, when you look, top three or four, either way you look at it, to me. Very, very solid. Probably not the best movie ever, but still better than, you know, I think all three of the prequels. Probably better than Return of the Jedi. So, yeah, at least top three of all the movies. I think I can safely say that. Now, once it's all said and done, I have a feeling episode 8 may just eclipse everybody. It remains to be seen. You know, we've all wanted to see what happens to Luke, and you know, hopefully he has more lines than he did in the last movie. So, anyway, there's that. That is The Force Awakens. Now, of course, there may be some things I'm not remembering right now as the movie is playing in front of me, and I'm watching Snoke talk to General Hux and say, "General!" And then something about, we must change our strategy, let's use the weapon, yada, yada, yada. I guess we should talk about predictions, right? I don't really have any. I'm kind of left with, we really don't have any idea of where it's going to go and what's going to happen. A lot of people are saying that Luke is going to end up giving himself in a sacrificial act and die in episode 8, and you know, I hope not. I hope we've seen our mentor character die already. But I think in the end, episode 9 probably, you know, we're probably going to see Luke pass on into the Force, at least by episode 9. So I don't think it's going to happen in episode 8. I'm really looking forward. You know, we never really got to see a really great look at Luke as a full-fledged Jedi. Nor have we really gotten a good look at Darth Vader as a full-fledged Sith Lord. Now, if you're watching Star Wars Rebels, yeah, you get that. You do get a lot of that. But you know, right now, you know, we haven't got that up until this point as far as the movies go. And I'm really, really hoping that we see Darth Vader in Rogue One. And speaking of the Rogue One trailer, lots of cool stuff there. But who is the person in the hooded cloak? That's the big question. You know, who is that person? We know it's not Darth Vader because Darth Vader didn't have a hood on his cape. He had a helmet. We think it could be Palpatine, but Palpatine's not going to kneel down to somebody. unless, and this didn't occur to me, unless it is Palpatine and his master is Snoke. Maybe Snoke shows up in Rogue One and this is where he comes from. You know, and everybody's going to be, oh, it's Darth Plagueis. Darth Plagueis. No, I don't think it's Darth Plagueis. I think he's Snoke. He is his own character. And, you know, he's not somebody else. He is Snoke. That's who he is. That's his name. Darth Plagueis, I think, died way before that because, I mean, even if everything else Palpatine said is a lie, one thing is still true, and that is he killed his own master while he slept. And that was the thing, you know. He was Darth Sidious. Plagueis was the master. He took Plagueis's place and then had apprentices. So I think it's entirely possible, you know, Snoke's not a Sith Lord. I think he's kind of above that. He's beyond that. He's something else. You know, Kylo was not a Sith. He's the master of the Knights of Ren. And so it's all very, very interesting. And, but my personal favorite theory is that the person in the hooded cloak is the Emperor's Hand, Mara Jade. That the Emperor is in a cryostasis of some sort. That's his cryogenic chamber. He's got the two Imperial guards. I mean, who but the Hand of the Emperor would have the access right there? So I think it's very possible that that could be where they're going. It would be cool if they did, but it's probably not, if we're being honest. So anyway, I have taken up enough of your time. We're getting on 42 minutes long. I appreciate it if you've listened this far. I hope I've said some things that get you thinking, and I really hope to get your feedback. You can get in touch with me by emailing at survivalguide@adventuresofindianajim.net. Or you can always visit adventuresofindianajim.net, click on the Star Wars Survival Guide logo, leave a comment there on the blog, and we can get this discussion going. So thanks very much for listening, and I will see you next week.